I'd like to introduce Janine Larson. She begins serving the UUA in 2004 as district executive in the Pacific Northwest, following a career in nonprofit organization management and consulting. As the UU has regionalized, her role has expanded to serve congregations throughout the West as part of a larger staff team. Janine is a lay leader and is a member and past president of the Woodinville UU Church near Seattle. Along with UU, she practices Zen Buddhism, which helps her to stay balanced and enjoy cheap golf with the benefits of a high handicap.
Thank you, Shanta. It's great to be here with you this morning and to hear your stories and all that you share of your communities and individual happiness and your griefs. It is a privilege. It's been a long time since I was last with you on a Sunday morning. That was way back in 2008. So your congregation has grown and changed, and I see so many faces here that I don't recognize, and several that I do. It's a privilege and a delight to be with you today. Back then, as Shanta said, I'd been 4 years on the job as district executive in the Pacific Northwest, and I played a role in the founding of this congregation along with your leaders and the UU Congregation of Salem, which served as your mentoring congregation. So it's wonderful to see you continuing to grow strong, and I hope that you are also continuing to understand your interdependent roots and wings in our Unitarian Universalist Association. One way that you can increase your knowledge is by sending voting delegates and others, perhaps including yourselves, to the district annual meeting in Seattle on March 9th. So you can see the Pacific Northwest District website at pnwd.org for details. I've just come from a week of traveling and picked up a bad cold there. One of the gifts of traveling isn't that great, especially when they're associated with meetings and being enclosed in a little room. So sorry if I sound a little hoarse. I'll try not to cough and hack into the microphone, though, so we can still talk with one another pretty well. So let's see. When I spoke to you in those early years of your beginnings, I talked then about UU values. And today, I want to expand on that to consider how our UU values can help us address evil in the world and its presence as a contrast to good, the shadow side, the opposition, the beast, the companion. This is a great duality living within each of us and in the world, and it is one of the great topics religion struggles to command. What constitutes evil in our world today, and why are we so obsessed with it? If you turn on any news outlet, check into any social media, or if you're really a glutton for punishment, if you watch the presidential debates, you can't escape it. Apparently, evil is all around us, in terrorism, in violent mental illness, in bullying, in someone else's politics, in the myriad ways we are killing each other and the earth, and most of all, per the current fixation in religious fanaticism. In his recent book, Not in God's Name, Confronting Religious Violence, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks explores what he calls altruistic evil, describing it as an evil committed in a sacred cause in the name of high ideals. This violence is described by Rabbi Sacks as delivered in the name of righting a wrong for the benefit of the oppressed, with the ultimate goal of returning a sinful world to holiness, that souls might be saved and a deity glorified. This is distinguished from garden variety evil, which, as a practicing Zen Buddhist, I understand as acts that are marked by Buddhism's three poisons: greed, anger, and ignorance. I'm trying to read my notes here and I can't quite read them. So those three poisons, in truth, I could see that ignorance really is at the root of religiously based violence, I would say. Rabbi Sacks notes that religion is not a prerequisite for altruistic evil, though religious crusades stand out for us as particularly horrific, probably because the perpetrators insist that their guiding religion is one of peace and righteousness. But Rabbi Sacks points out that in a survey of 1,800 conflicts in the Encyclopedia of Wars, who even knew there was an Encyclopedia of Wars, but there is, he found that less than 10% involved religion at all. It turns out that most wars are acts of bloody political revenge in response to recent or historic slights and offenses. Another study found that religion is conveniently invoked by secular despots about 40% of the time. It's a tactic to inspire fear and shift blame to an exotic scapegoat. Fear is a great manipulator, the primary tool of a bully. We are seeing that in spades this election cycle, even more than the last. When laborers fear the economy, we are a much more compliant workforce. When voters fear the enemy, we choose those who promise to protect us. Politics is about power, notes Rabbi Sacks. Political terrorism is employed to set people against one another while building up the supposed power and threat of the other to mythic proportions. This is designed to convince citizens they are powerless and must relinquish their freedoms to a savior who can vanquish the evil foe, restore order, and be hailed as a mighty hero. So in the face of all this, what are we to do to end evil? One popular religious message is to tell us to surrender to fear, to let go and let God. This is a favorite of dominionists among the Abrahamic traditions, that is, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, wishing to hasten the end of times and to fully reestablish God's kingdom. It is a favorite, too, of the ruling class who often position themselves as a stand-in for God. And at least some of those pushing altruistic evil are not just sociopaths using religion as a cover. They actually believe that the world will be at peace only when everyone converts and obeys the holy law as their interpretation of faith demands. Though even in fanaticism, it turns out there is no one lasting interpretation of how the faith must be kept. Buddhists find the answer in vanquishing fear by overcoming the evil impulses of the three poisons through the specific antidotes of non-attachment to disarm greed, loving kindness to dissolve anger, and cultivation of wisdom to dispatch ignorance. But without the need to invoke any religious view, here's what makes sense to me. First, get a grip on reality. Remember that news tends to be news because it's an anomaly, not the norm. In September 2015, Harvard psychology professor Steven Pinker published an article in The Guardian Online updating statistics on worldwide violence that he has been tracking since 2007, capturing data from 1990 to the present. He found that civil wars, notably in Ukraine and the Middle East, have in fact ticked up, though still less than half the 1992 rate of worldwide deaths due to civil war. He also found that the rate of every other kind of violence has stuck to its recent low or declined even further. This includes war deaths, homicides, crackdowns on dissent, sexual assault and domestic violence, capital punishment, criminalization of LGBT persons, and even sport hunting in the United States. Second, back away from the media. Sensationalism sells, and it's no accident that we live in a 24/7 breaking news society. Let us be clear that this is not actual news. It's promotion. It's promotion of obsessive compulsion, and it is nothing less than promotion of addiction. A great partner of marketing and manipulation, because it clouds the mind and compromises free will. Yes, we need to educate ourselves to be responsible citizens of the world and proper stewards of our communities and environment and guardians of our families. But no, we do not need to know everything that's reported by every outlet every minute. Get a grip and reclaim your life and your ability to discern what's really happening, what's really important, and what you're going to do to broadly research so you can discern facts from pants on fire. And what would you do about all this? Well, let's look a little bit at the role of our religion, and specifically that fourth principle of our faith, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. James Luther Adams, born and raised in Ritzville, Washington, is considered the preeminent Unitarian theologian of the 20th century. You ever heard of him? James Luther Adams. Look him up, because he's pretty interesting. He taught us that church is a place where you get to go to practice what it means to be human. Congregations and fellowships like this one, at their core, are about people and their tender needs, about joys, and especially about sorrows. It is about staying in the community even when you don't want to. It is about keeping the faith with people when we don't like them, when they behave badly, or when we do. It's about working through it, forgiving, atoning, and beginning again in love. Church is about life and helping us live it, come what may. Religion is not a simple set of rules and myths unless we allow it to devolve that way. Religion, in fact, is an invitation to making meaning, transformation, and action through the intentional spiritual practice of life. This is accomplished both communally and individually. We must do our best to stand on the side of love, to stop others from manifesting evil. To do so, we must first strengthen our own response to evil and choose to manifest good. The spiritual practice of life requires us to come to know ourselves, to care for ourselves, and to realize a purposeful life. UU lay leader David Reinick, who is now also co-abbot of the Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts, said in his leadership workshop at UU University prior to the 2007 UUA General Assembly in Portland that spiritual practice is what we do repeatedly with the intention of moving closer to that which is most true and alive for us. Spiritual practice is what we do repeatedly with the intention of moving closer to that which is most true and alive for us. So what does it mean to have a spiritual practice? In its deepest and most personal sense, spiritual practice is nonverbal. Pre-verbal, maybe. Its most profound effects can be experienced, but not quite explained. It can be approached through the best of our arts, poetry, painting, sculpture, music, dance, but it remains a singular rapture, approached only in metaphor, but never grasped in fact. So, listening again, to David Reinick's definition, spiritual practice is what we do repeatedly with the intention of moving closer to what is most true and alive for us. Here are four aspects of spiritual practice that I think are necessary to touch the soul, to transform us, and to unfold meaning in the experience of life. Ritual, contemplation, connection, and action. So ritual is a repetitive physical manifestation of metaphoric action. The purpose of ritual is to provide a familiar container and pattern so that you can relax into deeper meaning without having to consciously define it. Contemplation is a time of going down into your deepest self. It is intensely internal, stripped away from all pretense, raw and bare. It is receptive and vulnerable. It includes surrender and honesty, great courage, and great trust. Connection is spiritual work with others, fellow seekers and practitioners, wise leaders, teachers and mentors, community members at all different levels of spiritual maturity. This is where we learn patience and tolerance and love and forbearance. This is where we live compassion, discipline, and boundaries. It is where we move through the cycle of leadership, apprentice, practitioner, master, mentor. Action is where our spiritual practice is made manifest. This is where we harvest the wisdom seeded and grown in the fields of spiritual practice and nourish the lives of those around us, including the world that depends on us. You will see echoes of the first three of these aspects in any religion's worship services. In UU Sunday services, we are typically charged, when the chalice is extinguished, to go out and live our faith boldly in lives through our daily acts. But do we? I invite you to consider your spiritual practice more intentionally and develop it mindfully. Pay attention to where you feel most alive and true. If you respond to nature, for example, can you plan for a regular time in your element? Can you recognize the importance of ritual there in deepening your experience of nature, walking in silence while counting your steps or breath, maybe, or standing at a specific point and holding your arms out and noticing the feeling of the out of doors through every pore? What qualities might spiritual practice allow you to explore and make more abundant in every aspect of your life? What is your personal call to counter evil and promote good in the world? In our communal experience, Unitarian Universalist mission and ministry differs from that of many religions because it is based in covenant, not in creed. In practice, that is, not in belief. We rely on our shared values rather than dogma to keep us focused, and we depend upon shared covenant, the agreements we hold sacred in our company, to help us navigate the uncertain waters of the unknown and the unfamiliar, to arrive at the truth as it is constantly evolving and being revealed. The Reverend Dr. John Burens, a past president of the UUA, notes that UUs do not require common beliefs, but we do ask one another, what hopes do we share? What promises are we willing to undertake in order to realize those hopes? And how shall we treat one another along the way? These are covenantal questions, not creedal tests. And the Reverend John Gibbons of Bedford, Massachusetts says, I believe our churches exist to serve the cause of liberal religion, that is, to spread the gospel that all people are worthy. were more people to follow liberal religious ideals of generosity, compassion, justice, tolerance, and love, I am convinced that our world would be a better place. Ours is an enterprise that is life-saving, he says, and world-changing. It's time to let others in on our little secret. Many very good and important things are happening here, he reminds us, and our outward-facing faith obligates us to invite others in. This is the religious and spiritual practice, both individual and communal, that you must be about here and now in the Willamette Valley. It is a crucial application these days. We have much to learn and we have much to teach. Our future is changing in ways that even the wisest among us are unable to clearly predict. Anxiety, panic, fear, and despair are all around us. The religious question is, how do we de-escalate evil in our lives? And the religious answer is, by cultivating fearlessness. Our UU congregations can be a place to practice a different relationship with fear, looking at ourselves honestly and seeing clearly how our fear arises and how we respond to it. With practice, we can disarm the weapon of fear that is inside us. Then we can look at the unknown with stability, curiosity, and an invitation to insight, instead of immediately running with a panicked sense of loss and pain, dulling our senses, or freezing in the ostrich pose of denial, heads in the sand. In Unitarian Universalism, faith is what we practice between birth and death to get us through life. And UU faith is not a passive state. It is the state of being fearlessly alive, making the most of every moment, right now, exactly as it is unfolding. It is stepping into each moment, recognizing that your step is what is making your life and the world exactly what it is becoming. If we are to transform the world, we must transform ourselves first, individually and in community. We must become spiritually fit and strong, that we may offer a fearless faith more visibly, more intentionally, more prophetically to the world and to our neighbors. We, each of us, can offer the kind of faith that can't be taken away. Our religious values and practices can give us and others the moral courage and the spiritual strength to find comfort and reassurance in fearful and uncertain times, to live fully with troubling questions of evil, even when we don't know the answers, and to find that wisdom and steadiness, which must lead us to a world of greater peace and justice and caring for all, that wisdom and steadiness is right here, within each one of us, waiting only for us to share and receive and act. As the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. taught us all, darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that. May we be the love this world so desperately needs. May our very lives be the antidote to evil.
Please join with me in a meditative moment. At this time, Janine is open to comments and questions.
Well, first I have to say that at about 3 minutes, I think that you hold the prize for the longest period of being willing to sit in silence of any UU church I've visited. We may not be the people of the word, but we are definitely the people of the words. And it's hard for us to just stay still, so congratulations on that. Yes, please.
There's a recent article in Psychology Today about the dumbing down of America. I don't know if that's the title of it or not.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read that article, but, it has to do with, kind of instant gratification,
yeah.
What's going on in education and schools, what's going on politically, and I'm wondering if you can respond to that.
Yeah, sure. So Kathleen wondered about a recent article that's in Psychology Today that is talking about kind of the dumbing down of America. That may not be quite the title, but it's sort of the topic of it. I have not read that article, although it certainly sounds like it's worthy of reading. And is there any doubt that that's what's happening? I mean, does anybody feel like that's something that is not going on in the U.S. today? And again, for me, I see this as something that fulfills a purpose. This dumbing down turns us into sheep, right? To people who don't question, or maybe more like lemmings, because certainly we'll be falling off a cliff soon if we don't wake up and pay attention and begin to do something other than just following some leader that we can't even see, right? So that's, I guess, what strikes me most, and I find it alarming. Certainly that's something that we can speak to here in our congregations, because we are about the whole self. Feelings, emotions, and the intellect, and action, all of those things together. So let's resist that impulse. I don't think that's going to do our country any good. My personal opinion.
So I've gone through a place in my life a few years ago when I was filled with like anger and frustration and like violence, like dreams of violence, and I came to the conclusion that I was breathing poison on a daily basis, and I saw myself before as like, well, I'm the opposite of whatever they're doing, and I did have a personal experience of like finding within myself a place of love and compassion and trying to feel love for the people that I was so mad at all the time. And it has brought a huge change in my life. And I try to use the language of poison and toxicity when I talk to people and they're seething with anger towards one thing or another. And I don't know if I've ever helped anybody else. But I know that I personally feel better having found that, having found that model within myself, but I was in my mid-20s, early 30s, between my 20s and 30s, when I was just so frustrated, and a lot of it was listening to the media. Like, I used to listen to Air America, which was like a left-wing talk, and I was so frustrated and so angry all the time, and like, holidays were no fun anymore, because I would just yell at my parents.
Yeah.
So I'm sure I'm a much healthier, happier person to be around than I was. And I'm still very opinionated, and I'm still there,
So the trick there was that you decided to stop drinking the poison, didn't you?
Right.
And that makes the difference.
In the media.
Yeah, and then you also applied some healing antidotes of practicing some loving kindness just for yourself first.
Right, and that's where I started because I felt so toxic
active.
At one point.
Yeah,
I needed to move on.
Yeah, it's like doing a whole body cleanse, isn't it? Yeah, when you start.
So I have found those things, and they have helped me in my life.
That's great. Yeah, I just have no doubt with that. Thank you for sharing.
I like her better, Ken.
A few years ago for me, I decided I was tired of conforming to what other people thought I should be or act like or look like or anything like that. And if people couldn't accept me, I'm sorry, this is who I was, and if take a flying leap, I was done changing and trying to pretend like everybody else. And I At first it was looked down upon by my family, and then it was like one of those, oh, you're never, you know, you're acting like this. It's like, if you don't like it, I don't care anymore. This is who I am, accept me and love me or move on. And after that, after I came to that conclusion, and my family eventually came around and realized that I was serious about that, I was done with all that, I was so much happier with myself. I was so much more at peace. I quit pretending to be like everybody else, and I quit pretending to look like everybody else, and I became myself. I feel the nonconformists are the future. They're the ones that are going to save the sheep.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'll just share a reflection with you. I really do respond absolutely to the feeling of finding yourself and just being okay with that, you know, and living that fully and right out loud. I think that's really great. And there's also a little shadow side there that we can, that we all need to be aware of, I think, when we're in that search of self-discovery and then living it out, is to remember that we are also called to live in community. And sometimes we can be wrong. So, you know, this is exactly right, I think, except we also have to be other than completely self-referential. You know, we still do have things to learn, and we still have to be open to that. And so I sense that that's something that you've also incorporated into who you are and how you live. So thank you. I appreciate it.
What is most true and alive for you, and how has that evolved?
I think that for me, what I have found in my Zen Buddhist practice has been to be aware and with this very moment. Whatever is happening now, to live in this moment and live it out fully, rather than spinning into fantasy of what might be, or spinning into worry of what has been, and being obsessed by something that's not happening right here and now. For me, that is what I am finding in my own personal spiritual practice, to be with the moment and experience what's being given, and to just revel in it, whether it is grief or whether it is incredible beauty, or if I can't tell what it is, but just to stay with it. For me, that's what that piece is.
I was just going to ask you, do you take this message other places other than the UU Church?
Well, yes and no. For me, you know, because I also have this dual practice in Zen Buddhism, I do practice with various communities, and certainly, and I lead a couple of meditation groups in my own church that include people who are not UUs. About half of the group, both the groups are not UU. So I don't, you know, I'm not on the lecture circuit or anything like that. I do have the opportunity to speak to UUs a lot. And I also understand that how each of us engages the world pretty much is one at a time, right? So we all meet with different people, and you never know what their wide circles are. One thing that I do understand about Unitarian Universalists, though, is that we're pretty high on the percentage of people involved in activism scale, and we tend to be leaders ourselves. So as we transform ourselves, and myself included, the people I come in contact to, I cannot help but share some of that message. I just can't. And that's what I would like for all of us to recognize that we do and can do. And so, you know, radiate a little more. That's what I would say. Anything else?
Is this on?
Yes, we can hear you.
For a few years of my life, I was driving up I-5 on a monthly basis and driving back. And I was, now this is not a frivolous question, and something we could all apply, I'm sure. You travel a lot. because of your position. I sense that you probably don't have road rage. How do you...
Do you need a percentage?
Does any of your Zen Buddhism affect life on the road for you?
Yeah, all of it does. You know, I mean, we can't help but respond to what we're confronted with, right? We can't help but do that. What I find, though, is that with intentional practice, we start responding in a little bit different way, so that more consistently we can respond in a way other than anger or violence, even when we respond in fear, like this car just cut me off or something. We don't necessarily go to fear and then anger and violence as the next response. So I do see that, absolutely. And boy, traffic is a wonderful opportunity to practice forgiveness and loving kindness and patience, isn't it? Yeah, so there's your rolling laboratory right there, your rolling Zen hall. So. Yeah. Anything else? Wonderful. So great to be with you. Thank you so much. Yeah.